WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Howard and Alice Goodwin are transplants from the urban East Coast and have moved to Wisconsin to work a dairy farm and to find an easier and more secure life for themselves and their family. About halfway through Jane Hamilton's novel about the Goodwins, A Map of the World, Howard muses, "It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when our lives began to unravel. Was it the drowning of a neighbor's child who was visiting the Goodwins?" he asks. "Was it his wife's arrest for alleged child abuse?" A Map of the World is a searing account of guilt and forgiveness and an unflinching portrait of small-town mean-spiritedness. Reviewing A Map of the World for Newsweek magazine, Laura Shapiro wrote, "There's nothing garish or manipulative about Hamilton's approach to these events. She's exploring them, not exploiting them. Her tone is beautifully controlled, her style calm and lucid." Jane Hamilton, also a transplant from the East Coast, lives in Wisconsin where she and her husband are apple farmers. This is Jane Hamilton's second novel. Her first, The Book of Ruth, won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award in 1989. A Map of the World is just out in paperback. Let's begin with Jane Hamilton reading from the book.
The first part is narrated by Alice Goodwin, who's trying to be the farm wife, and she's babysitting at the beginning for her neighbor's children. And she realizes fairly early on, after they've arrived, that one of the littlest girl, Lizzie, is missing. And she's running around looking for the child. Lizzie's 2 years old. And she all of a sudden realizes that the kitchen door is wide open and that possibly the little girl has wandered off towards the pond. And so she heads out. She says, "Do not leave this house," I ordered, talking to her other children. And then I was out the door and across the garden, down the wooded lane to the pond. I suspect that when animals, a deer or a fox, run from their predators, they are governed by a keen intelligence. They do not waste their movements. And because they know the depth of the woods, the breadth of a field, they flee anticipating the curve of the land, the perfectly situated thicket. I ran like a blind person, stumbling over my own heavy limbs. When I came to the clearing, I couldn't see past the single glaring point of sunlight dancing on the water. I put my hand to my forehead to make a visor, and still it took me a minute to find the pink seersucker bottom just beneath the surface, about 15 feet from the beach. When I am forced to see those 10 minutes as they actually were, when I look clearly without the scrim of half-uttered prayers and fanciful endings, I am there, tall and gangly and clumsy and slow, crying out unintelligibly, splashing through the water to Lizzie. I had nothing of a hero's elegance or pace. As I moved, I was thinking, she's fine, she's fine. People don't really drown in shallow places. That's an old wives' tale. She's probably looking for minnows or stones or snails so far from the shore. I pulled her up and slung her over my shoulder, tripping through the water, screaming then, screaming for help. I didn't know how to make enough noise to be heard. I was shrieking with so much force I felt as if I might split, and yet all the world was placid, still. The leaves in the trees hung limp like palsied hands. I lay Lizzie on her back, that was right, and then I tilted her chin and put my ear to her cold chest and tried to listen. It was impossible to hear anything but the noise of myself panting and dripping and the bamming of my own sturdy heart. Lizzie's skin was rubbery, her face the gray of an old carp, her lips dark as blueberries. Her wide, unblinking eyes were the color of mud. I opened my mouth and screeched again. I'm sure I felt for her pulse before I tore her jumpsuit and began pumping wildly on her chest.
That's Jane Hamilton reading from her book called A Map of the World. I have to tell you, this is a very hard book to read. The things that happen in this book are things I don't even want to think about. But what is it to write about it? Because I would think as a writer, you have to live. I mean, almost listening to you read that passage, you have to live this stuff, don't you?
I think I wrote it because I wanted, as a parent, I feel that every next step is the disaster and waiting to happen. And it's just by whatever luck or some would say grace that, you know, you escape and have good fortune. And And I feel, I think maybe just the opposite of you. I feel that if I look at something, if I really look at it, then it won't happen. And I think that, you know, part of the pleasure of writing is stepping into somebody else's skin and learning what they teach you.
Well, I will say it was a hard book to read, but once I started to read it, I couldn't put it down. So I wanted to look too, but I think this is the kind of stuff that's every parent's nightmare. And I agree with you. I think most parents whose children survive into adulthood just think they're lucky.
Yes, yes. Actually, you know, it's been interesting going around the country. Often people will come and say, why did you write such a sad book? But actually, I think there's a lot of funny bits in it, too. But I met someone who said just a really nice, just a lovely thing that kind of summed up, I think, also why I wrote it. He said it was a comfort to go through that grief.
Hmm.
And, you know, it sort of took my breath away because it really expressed to me why I wrote the book.
Did this come from a particular incident that you knew about, you read about, you heard about?
When my son was two and going to a babysitter for about 12 hours a week, there was another little boy who was his age who drowned in the family swimming pool. And, you know, I didn't really know them, but it was horrifying and just so sad. And I felt, you know, that this was something that could happen mm-hmm. to anyone. And I, you know, I could imagine just the guilt the parents must feel. They, you know, I'm sure they thought they turned their back for a few minutes and then the child was gone.
Well, this little girl that does drown and does die, I don't think I'd be giving too much away by saying that. The girls, these mothers are very good friends.
Yes.
And in certain ways, the mother of the child that drowns is able to mourn in a way that Alice can't.
Yes.
And the question is, what do you say to someone in that position who is responsible for another person's child, and that child dies? There's almost nothing worse to contemplate.
I know. I think that's, you know, also I certainly have had many times when the neighbor children are over. And, you know, I can think of several instances when I didn't know where they were, or they're in the barn and maybe they've gotten bitten by a rabid raccoon. I don't know, any number of things. And, you know, and yet you have to let them live. So that, too, has been my nightmare.
More from Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World, after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World. Now, you start the story out with an unspeakable tragedy that happens to Alice and to this little girl. And then you add on to that. I mean, not too many pages later, some policemen come to her at a school meeting and begin to question her about her relationship with a child at school. She's a school nurse. And more tragedy
yes.
is heaped on her. Why did you want to do this to this poor character?
Well, actually, most of the things that I've written, I've known the last line, and so the story or the book is like a journey to that last line. And when I started this book, I knew that the beginning was the drowning, that was the kernel, and I knew that Alice got into this trouble because of it, but I didn't understand how she got out of her trouble or what she had to learn, and I actually wrote four distinct novels, all with different plots, trying to figure out how to get her free. All of them didn't go down deep in any way, and I really didn't understand what she had to learn. So it was in probably 89 or 90 that I read about a couple of cases where people were apparently unjustly convicted of abusing children. And it was horrifying, and I was really gripped with the idea of how easy it is to have your life taken from you and how you have no recourse and the system takes over. And particularly with children, there's really no way to get at the truth after years have passed. And so I thought, this is the perfect trouble for Alice. Mm-hmm. And I realized that she had to get in deeper before she came clear. And yet I resisted writing about it because it seems that every novel you open is about abuse.
Well, that's right. This is a very tricky issue to try to write about in a complex way.
Well, and I also, you know, I thought, how am I going to write about this without sounding like the Monday Night Movie?
Mm-hmm.
So I resisted taking it on, but after a while I thought, well, I felt duty bound to her to get her out of the trouble, and so I thought, I think this is the only way.
Were you interested in testing Alice then and taking her sort of heaping as much suffering as you possibly could on one woman and see what she would do.
I don't think I thought about it in such a conscious way. So much happens on an intuitive level. People have asked me that, you know, why did you give her so much trouble? You know, I don't think it ever occurred to me that it was more than she could handle, and that I think I knew that her strengths would surface, and that she in a way, you know, she really, when the abuse situation arises, she feels that it's an opportunity to pay her pound of flesh, and in a way she's grateful for the trouble.
And the pound of flesh because of the guilt over the drowning. So a way of balancing that.
Right.
Do you identify with being in a situation, which certainly Alice is in, of being accused of something that you can't really defend yourself against?
Well, I was in a situation just with a neighbor where the little girls were doing something that I thought was fine and my neighbor was appalled by. And this was my best friend.
What was it?
It's in there. They were running around without their clothes on, jumping on the bed. And my neighbor said, "What is it about your sexed house?"
And that's a direct quote.
Yes,
I
did use it. I did use it. And I was so shocked that here was somebody I thought we shared a sensibility. I thought nothing was wrong. I remember doing that as a kid. And she just didn't have that in her experience. And she actually is a therapist and deals with a lot of sexual abuse. And I sort of realized that she didn't have perspective on what was normal and healthy. But it really scared me. And it was just about the time that I was seeing these things and I thought, my God, this could happen to me. And, you know, a few little misunderstandings.
What did you say to her?
I said, I really think that this is normal, that they're just exploring and we need to respect their privacy. And and then I called everybody that night that I'd grown up with and knew and said, did you take your clothes off when you were kids? You know, I was really unsettled. And then I realized that she had probably lost perspective with her profession. And later we talked about it. I mean, we let a little time go by and we talked about it, and she's been very generous about it and read the book, and we've laughed about it, and she's been wonderful.
But did she keep her child away from your house?
For a little while. She said they couldn't play dress-up anymore because that entailed taking their clothes off.
Wow.
And that they had to put their tutus on over their clothes.
Let me shift gears if I can. Now, you do live in an apple orchard. Your husband is that was a little Freudian slip there. Your husband is an apple farmer. I assume
yes.
That makes you an apple farmer too?
I started out helping him full time, and then I had children, and we had children, and that sort of absolved me of some of my duties. And then when I could justify spending time writing, what I'm trying to say is I don't help as much as I used to.
You feel guilty about it?
No, I feel guilty that I don't feel guilty. But I really enjoy, I enjoy picking apples, and there's a wonderful harvest fall feeling on a weekend when people are making their annual trek to buy apples, and it's quite wonderful. It's very intense. It's my husband. You know, I see him. I think he feels like a slave and a king in the same breath.
Uh-huh.
Because he's his own boss. But he and his partner work like pack mules. They work very hard.
And do you think the kind of rhythm of farm life is that conducive to writing?
No. It's really full time.
It never stops.
It never stops,
mm-hmm.
And it's very immediate. I used to, you know, sit up in my office and watch them all heaving and sweating, and the apples are there. You can't wait, but a story can wait.
Mm-hmm.
A story theoretically doesn't rot. You know, I feel very fortunate that I can help where I can, but that I also can do my other thing, as it were.
Do you feel confident, though, that a story can't rot? And I would think that,
no, a story rots. A story does
rot. That's what I would think. And if you can't get something down on paper, then maybe you've lost it.
Right. I think there's an urgency to it every bit as much as the apple mm-hmm. on the bough. But of course, it's not tangible. So for years it was hard just for myself to justify spending the time on it.
Do you think you're a good writer?
Do I think I'm a good writer? I, you know, there's parts of this book that I can't look at because it makes me wince, and there's other places that I feel proud of and that I feel are finished. But I don't think that anything is ever really done. I could work on this book very happily for another year.
Jane Hamilton's second novel, A Map of the World, has recently come out in paperback by Anchor Books. This is Fresh Air.